From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative health care, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today, very exciting author, David Hatcher Childress. We are going to talk about one of many books that he has written. The book we're going to talk about today, Vimana, Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis. This is a book, folks, that is about the possibility that the ancients had very incredible technology on aircraft flight. Matter of fact, after reading this book, I began to realize that perhaps our flight, the types of aircraft that we have, are nowhere near as sophisticated as the aircraft they had over 4,000 years ago. I'd like to welcome to the show David Childress. David, welcome.
Wow, thank you, Bruce.
You have written, and I think we should let everyone know the names of some of the other books. You have written books called Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of Africa and Arabia, The Anti-Gravity Handbook, The Lost Cities of Ancient Lemuria and the Pacific, The Lost Cities of North and Central America, which is your new book, Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India, The Anti-Gravity and the World Grid, and Anti-Gravity and the Unified Field. There seems to be quite a bit of interest in all of these for you. The book, as I said before, that we're going to talk about today, Vimana Aircraft. What is a Vimana Aircraft?
Well, okay, a Vimana is a Sanskrit term still used today in Hindi, and it refers to an aerial vehicle, a sky chariot, an airplane, if you will. Could even refer to a spacecraft, any kind of vehicle which is airborne, per se. And we get the term Vimana is a word used in Sanskrit that's been used in ancient India and other Sanskrit-derived languages for many thousands of years. I believe it's a term that goes back at least 10,000 years. You'll find the term Vimana used in such popular Indian epics as the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, works like this. There are even actual texts coming from ancient India which are wholly, entirely about Vimanas and what's in them. It's a fascinating subject, and one which, by the way we look at history today, seems just incredibly fantastic and probably impossible to many so-called scholars in this field.
Now, the particular text that we're speaking about was, not necessarily translated back in the 50s, but it was presented in the 50s, wasn't it?
It was first presented in English in the 50s. Not until 1972, I believe. But a Sanskrit scholar in Mysore, which is a major city in central India, he began his work in the 40s and 50s and 60s translating the Vimanika Shastra, which is apparently a 4th century BC text, into what we would say is modern Hindi and in English as well. This book was then published in 1972 by the International Sanskrit Academy in Mysore in a very special limited volume edition, which was bound in silk and was the first half of the book of about 150 pages was all in Hindi, which is a Sanskrit-derived language, and then the second part of the book, another 150 or so pages, was the English translation, plus some illustrations that had been drawn in 1923 from the text were also included in that first edition. That book became so rare, and I mean, just sort of a book that was so incredible, it almost immediately achieved a legendary status. I've got several copies of this book, and I mention it in all my books on lost cities and even my books on anti-gravity. I often would refer to this text, and I would get letters from my readers saying, you know, wow, David, loved your books and all that, and you mentioned this book called the Vimanika Shastra, all about these ancient Indian Vimanas. Where do I get a copy of that book? And this is very difficult to get a copy of, particularly now. Unfortunately, Mr. Joshur, the translator, is dead now. And what I decided to do was really just for people to easily be able to have this text as a reference, because I believe it's very important. I decided to publish a book, the book we're discussing, Vimana Aircraft of Ancient Indian Atlantis, and put the entire text in there so that for scholars and anybody to reference. Plus, also in that book are my own discussions on the ancient Rama Empire and ancient India, what it supposedly was like, as described in the texts, as well as, in the back of the book, an analysis of the text, and just exactly, you know, what they were talking about, the concepts and technology that these ancient authors were trying to convey.
All right, now, for those of you who may have just tuned in, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio, and my guest today, David Hatcher Childress, and we're talking about a book that he has written entitled Vimana Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis. These are not just airplanes. These are actually like UFOs, aren't they?
That's right. Apparently, there was five different kinds of Vimanas that were built in ancient India, and typically they were in some kind of circular design, either like a disc, what we would call a flying saucer, or as a tubular cylindrical shape, similar to the cigar-shaped UFOs that are sometimes talked about. Like a Zeppelin, really, and throughout my book I often use the analogy of Zeppelin-type craft as, you know, what certain types of Vimanas were like.
Now, for those of you who are listening, the Vimanika Shastra, which is the name of the text that all this information came from, actually has definitions, training of pilots, aerial routes, the parts, clothing, the food you should eat, the metals, how to make these heat-absorbing metals, melting them, putting mirrors in the aircraft, how they're powered, yantras and or machinery, parts of the yantras, the varieties. It's incredible. What is your comment on all this? You've done all the studying.
Fantastic, and it's neat, the whole thing. And I would like to point out that the Vimanika Shastra is no vague, you know, book about, you know, people in their air chariots flying around. Highly technical and specific book talking about the mechanics, the working, you know, machines, and how these things fly. It's a literal aircraft manual for these books. See, now, it's important to realize the whole perspective that we have to put from Vimanas and the Vimanika Shastra into, which is the fantastic civilization of ancient India. I call that civilization the Rama Empire. And we say it's the Rama Empire because we take that from the very famous, well-known Hindu epic of the Ramayana. Now, within the Ramayana, which is a book actually contained within the Mahabharata, we have a story that is like the wildest science fiction, and to just like our Bible is today, and you know, legends we have of whatever ancient past, like Moses and whatnot. This is, you know, very similar to Hindus in India. I mean, they all know about this book, but the kind of things that are going on in the story of the Ramayana are pretty fantastic. It's like some Buck Rogers, you know, movie, only, you know, this is all happening 5, 6, 7, 8,000 BC. People are jumping into their aircraft, their Vimanas, roaring off and chasing each other. They have battles with these, like, super weapons with each other. And it's clearly stated in the epics, you know, what they're doing and what a vimana is. And it's not vague in the sense that, oh, they're really just talking about getting in their little two-wheeled chariot, you know, drawn by a couple of horses. No, that's they have those too. That's something else. But vimanas are absolutely these aerial machines that they use. The story of the Ramayana is an interesting one that I can just paraphrase briefly. It's a story of a Hindu prince named Rama and his beloved wife, Sita. Now, Sita is suddenly kidnapped by the evil guy in the show. His name is Ravana. And what Ravana does, he falls in love with Sita, and he kidnaps her in his vimana and takes her off to the island of Lanka, where he holds her captive and tries to get her to fall in love with him. But she's pure and all that kind of thing, and she, you know, it's like Rama, her prince and husband, is the only man for her kind of thing. And eventually, through the help of various friends of Rama's, that kind of thing, he finds out where she's located. He gets into his vimana and goes over to the island of Lanka, and they have a big battle in the sky kind of thing. He rescues his wife, and he returns to the Ayodhya forest, which is in north central India, and, you know, he and his wife are back together. So it's kind of a romantic, chivalrous tale of, you know, love and intrigue and kidnapping and, you know, two men vying for the affection of one woman.
Now, the Rukma Vimana, okay, is a big, this is a giant machine here. It's got four floors. Why don't you describe this to our listeners? Well, it looks like
the Rukma Vimana.
Right. It says, for example, it's got Pitta, which is the bottom floor, and then the controlling platform, and the next one is passengers platform, and another passengers platform. This is a big machine here.
Right, like a four deck circular craft. The Rukma Vimana would be pretty much analogous to what we would call a flying saucer. Large, you know, 40, 50, 60 feet in diameter, with different stories within the craft. Totally discoid, and curiously running on some electric magnetic power, something akin to anti-gravity. In fact, the Vimanika Shastra talks about the use of crystals, mercury vortexes, electricity, that kind of sort of, what we call it, a little bit of an oddball type technology, at least one that we're not really using today. For instance, the methods that we use for flight at this point are largely airfoils, with you know, where you have to have wings, and the air goes over, you know, the wing. It creates a low and a high pressure zone. The airplane is lifted. Or we're using a kind of a helium technology, such as used in blimps and zeppelins, that kind of thing. Or, I mean, the last type of technology we're using to get things into space and whatnot is rocket technology, where we're literally sending explosive missiles, you know, into the air, sort of lighting the back end, and these rockets go off. But the technology that is being used in Vimanas is something like a UFO technology, the way UFOs are described as, you know, having a glow around them, and that there's a fiery radiation. There's an artificial gravity field being created. Oftentimes, the craft seems to be spinning in a gyroscopic type effect. This is the kind of technology being used in these Vimanas. And, I mean, to most people today, that seems like a science fiction technology of the future. Although I've tried to prove in my other books on anti-gravity that this technology is known on this planet and goes back to even before World War II. The kind of devices built by Nikola Tesla and Victor Schauberger, T. Townsend Brown. Even the stealth bomber is said to have some kind of technology similar to this. For various reasons, I believe that this kind of technology, an anti-gravity type technology, is suppressed, largely, I think, for economic reasons.
Yeah, because there's no reason to use any kind of fossil fuels, obviously, for them, right?
No, that's right. I mean, once you have, you know, your Vimana built, and all the parts are in place, it's like It's a system, it's a closed system that works in a electromagnetic gravitational way. And although you're still going to need some kind of power source, and exactly, you know, something developing, you know, say electricity or something like it, once you get these things going, yeah, they just take off and move. Exactly like UFOs.
Let me mention to the listeners that the Caduceus, I believe that's the way it's pronounced, is a simplified diagram of this Mercury Vortex engine. And this is exactly what doctors use as their symbol, isn't it?
That's right. And it's used as the medical symbol. And in fact, curiously, the Caduceus is also identified with the ancient Greek god Mercury. And Mercury, I mean, where this is the god where we get the name for our, this metal, this liquid metal, Mercury, which is in thermometers and that kind of thing. I mean, his name is Mercury. He was the messenger of the gods. He flew through the air. And his symbol, again, was the caduceus. And what is the caduceus? The caduceus shows two snakes intertwining amongst themselves in a coil, in a vortex-type pattern, and it was a pole between them with a ball at the bottom and a ball at the top, and then there was wings that are drawn onto each side of the caduceus, symbolizing flight. Now, I believe, and other researchers into Vimanas believe, that the caduceus is a symbol of the Vimana and the technology that is used in these Vimanas, which is essentially a Mercury vortex type propulsion.
Now, for those of you who are listening, this is in Chapter 5 of the Vimanika Shastra. This is an example of how this stuff is actually written out, and we're talking specifically about how to create this Mercury vortex engine. It actually says, prepare a square or circular base of 9 inches width with wood and glass. Mark its center, and from about an inch and a half thereof, draw lines to the edge in 8 directions. Fix 2 hinges in each of the lines in order to open and shut. This is the kind of information we're talking about, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. And again, I want to point out, I mean, to skeptics, and I mean, it's good to be skeptic about this subject, but this, when speaking of Vimanas and the ancient Indian texts and the Vimanika Shastra, they're not vague texts at all. I mean, but particularly the Vimanika Shastra, highly detailed engineering-type treatise. Now, it's a little bit hard for us to decipher everything because it's written in archaic Sanskrit and then, you know, translated many times over. But, I mean, it's pretty clear what they're talking about. And there's no question that they are talking about mechanical devices which fly through the air. I mean, at the very least, these things are some kind of Zeppelin-type craft, you know, using helium or hydrogen or just some lighter-than-air gas. But by the own text itself, it's something more complicated, more technological, a kind of an anti-gravity device.
Now, they talk about electromagnetic lift and repulsion, and of course, the vortex propulsion. What is the difference between those two, if there is one?
Well, all right. We start to get into the whole science of gravity control, anti-gravity. This goes also into Einstein's unified field. Einstein postulated that electricity and magnetism and gravity, as well as what's called the nuclear force, all manifested from a unified field, one force. And Einstein called this the unified field, and gravity and magnetism and electricity were all interrelated within this field. For instance, just as we have equations for electromagnetism, according to Einstein, there would be equations for electrogravity or magnetogravity. And gravity is itself some manifestation of this field, and gravity itself is also some kind of electromagnetic phenomenon of one type or another. Therefore, once you understand this kind of technology, there would be a way through electricity and magnetics to engineer an artificial gravity field. Could be an anti-gravity where you're repelled by the Earth's gravity. It can be a kind of mini gravitational field, which, you know, allows you to act independently of the Earth's gravitational field and sort of pushing against it, that kind of thing. for instance, with this kind of technology, once your anti-gravity field was turned on, you would literally fall up instead of down. This is the kind of thing being talked about in the text itself. Now, again, back to the example of a simple gyroscope, which, you know, could be like a toy they sell. That gyroscope, while spinning and standing there on your table, is having an anti-gravity effect. But now, there would be other ways to get this sort of effect without the vortex movement or the spinning. For instance, you might have a solid-state flying saucer in which you merely are setting up a vibration or a field that's all solid state, like a frequency, and thereby using waveguides to guide this gravitational wave that you're generating, you'll then warp the field in the direction you want to go, whether that's up or sideways at some certain angle. But you can, in that way, in theory at least, circumvent the actual spinning vortex movement of the gyroscope. It's interesting to note that many UFOs that are reported do seem to be rotating or spinning. You know, then the lights are often spinning around. A very common effect in you know, the UFO field.
Basically, what we're talking about here is that the complete knowledge of not only that these aircraft existed, but how to build them is found in ancient texts, specifically the Vimanika Shastra text, which is from the Vedas, actually. David, we were going to talk for a moment about William Clendenin. I just wanted to enter his name in here. He's a very well-known UFO investigator, just to kind of corroborate some of your evidence. What did you find from his information?
Well, Bill has been in the UFO field for 20 or 30 years. He's well-known. And he's written a book, which is called Mercury, UFO Messenger of the Gods. And in his book, he details these Mercury gyro engines and talks quite a bit about them on it. It's an excellent book. And I really feel that Bill has done a great deal of very valuable work in this field of deciphering the ancient texts and trying to figure out exactly what they're talking about and how the technology they're talking about can be put to practical use. And starting in the 60s, he began designing these Mercury gyro craft, which are discoid craft, look exactly like flying saucers. They're designed from the ancient texts, and he's done a great deal of research into the Caduceus and the Mercury. It was a legendary figure and what its uses were. And he's come up with, I think, some pretty good diagrams, which are published in my book as well, with his permission, of exactly how these Mercury proton gyros and these Vimanas use those to develop the lift and propulsion that apparently these Vimanas had.
Can we talk for one moment about his basic turbopump engine, which has four main sections?
Well, we could. I think we've already discussed that. It's basically a gyro with mercury in it, and that the mercury is heated. Now, Ivan T. Sanderson pointed this out, too. If you take a pan of mercury and you begin to heat it, the mercury begins spinning in a clockwise vortex, just on its own. So therefore, the vortex pattern of mercury is already inherent within this element itself. Now, mercury is, too, not only a rare element, but one that's absolutely known in ancient times. The Mayan temples, and when they've done excavations down in Central America, they would find sometimes bowls of mercury, and they do not know where that mercury came from. It is said that mercury, first of all, comes from a stone called cinnabar, and cinnabar is also a Sanskrit name. Now, we know that mercury was well known to the ancient Indians of India, but the only cinnabar mines and source of mercury known in North America is California, as a matter of fact. So, the creation of first extracting mercury from cinnabar is itself a complicated process. Exactly why the Mayans and other ancient civilizations, you know, kind of had some big deal about mercury. And we really do find like pots of mercury in weird tombs and things like that.
So we can assume they didn't use them for thermometers.
Well, maybe, but it doesn't seem like it. And it just what, you know, and why they would even wanted to use mercury and going through the whole process of getting it, I mean, in a more simple, mundane level, you know, somebody might say, well, they were just fascinated by, you know, this strange liquid, silvery liquid. On the other hand, we're finding that mercury does have these very specific uses, and a mercury gyroscope that is electrified is going to have this lift, this anti-gravity effect, in which if the entire craft is built around such a gyro, you're going to have what is essentially a flying saucer.
Let's talk a little bit about ancient India. You have said in your book that a lot of the information that we are just talking about today has been lost, and that it's very special as far as India is concerned.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that India is important as far as ancient history goes and finding out what the past was like, because throughout history there has been the purposeful destruction of knowledge. Giant libraries are destroyed. The Library at Alexandria in Egypt is a well-known case where the Ptolemaic Greeks had set up to collect really all the knowledge in the world. They had a library of many hundreds of thousands of volumes in many different languages, including very valuable ancient Egyptian records and things like that. And in the 4th century A.D., this entire library was just completely destroyed. Similarly, Emperor Qihuangdi of China, the same emperor who built the Great Wall and had that army of weird terracotta warriors that they discovered, so famous, that emperor ordered every book in China destroyed. And this was about 300 B.C. or so. Now, even the only reason why we have many of the ancient Chinese books we have today, like the I Ching, that kind of thing, is only because they were kept in secret libraries. Similarly, the Spanish, when they conquered Central America, they destroyed all Mayan codexes that they could come across. So what we're really finding is that ancient knowledge has been destroyed, and there's been a tremendous interruption with the past and the present. Many conquerors and despotic dictators, what they wanted was history to start with them and destroy the past. Now, really the only civilization on our planet today in which this has really not happened in a large degree is India. And India has managed to maintain a direct link from the present right back into their very, very ancient times. And this was done by the two temples and libraries, mainly in central and southern India, a preservation of knowledge. Other knowledge was kept in monasteries in the Himalayas and in Tibet, which, you know, we've heard about. The Muslim invasion of India, which occurred in the 10th century, was also an effort to destroy their culture and destroy the knowledge of ancient India as well. However, the Mughals were never able to get really very far into central India, had to stop in the northern Indian areas. So I think that's what makes the Vimalika Shastra texts and other ancient tales of India so valuable, is that here are people with an ancient history that they've kept alive and, you know, in a scholarly way have pursued the past and are able to through these texts. Now, what these texts, you know, indicate is that, unlike what we're told, that 4,000 B.C. or something, you know, people in India were all just, you know, primitive farmers kind of things. We're often told, I mean, the official history of the planet is that, well, civilization began in Sumeria about that time, and before that people were cavemen, that kind of thing. And it's like a linear line on a graph of, you know, caveman here, and just draw a straight line up to the top of the graph, modern man here. But in actual fact, history is more of a roller coaster of ages of technology and enlightenment, and then a dark age following, and then more another climb up to another age of technology and enlightenment. It's a historical fact that Europeans in the Middle Ages were, you know, had a much lower degree of science and knowledge than the Greeks and Romans had 1,000 years before them. So here we can see very easily how these dark ages and ages of enlightenment are repeated throughout history, and these must go back many tens of thousands of years back to Atlantis and even earlier civilizations than that.
Now, the way you're talking, it's almost as though we're living in a dark age, aren't we?
Well, in a way, there's definitely a suppression of technology. There's a suppression of history. There's a suppression of what's really gone on in the past. I mean, this whole concept of cavemen, you know, a few thousand years ago, and then everyone just stepping out of their caves and building ziggurats and pyramids in Egypt kind of thing is entirely false and has been proven wrong over and over again, even by the conservative scholars themselves. Yet this strange, antiquated, dogmatic history is still being taught in our schools.
All right. We've got to move because we're going to run out of time if we don't do this. Let's talk about Atlantis and especially the Atlantean Valix.
Right. Now, another source of these kind of ancient craft is allegedly the continent of Atlantis. Now, a couple of interesting books were written in the turn of the century. One in particular was called A Dweller on Two Planets. And in that book, a book written in 1880 of all times, it talks about what it was like in ancient Atlantis. And ancient Atlantis was, according to them, also, like ancient India was, and according to the ancient Indian epics, a very sophisticated society with some very high technology. They used crystals. They, of course, had electricity and all kinds of sort of radar, radio-type devices and weapons. Also, they had, of course, aircraft. And those aircraft, they called, according to those books written about it, and these are not ancient texts, by the way, but more modern books that were written through various means. But what the Atlanteans had was a type of craft called a Valix. And a Valix, this was spelled V-A-I-L-X, and the L-X sound at the end sort of had an L-X sound. Those craft were virtually identical to what the Vimanika, Shastra, and other Indian records, talk about as a Vimana. Valixes, as described in these Atlantean texts, were typically tubular-shaped, cigar-shaped craft. They worked electromagnetically, using some sort of artificial gravity. Valix looked like a Zeppelin, a lot longer and thinner. And a Valix was capable of going underwater, too. So it not only looked kind of like a submarine, but it acted like a submarine, too. So you could not only fly it through the air, you could go underwater with it.
Now, a lot of this stuff came up with the Edgar Cayce readings, didn't it?
Absolutely. The Edgar Cayce readings in the 40s also confirmed all of this. And talking about the use of quartz crystals in this technology, the concept of radiating power through the atmosphere so the electrical devices would not have to be plugged into a wall. They would literally have like an antenna and pick up power directly from the atmosphere. Edgar Cayce also talked about the craft exactly like that. In fact, there's a very interesting Edgar Cayce reading in which he himself is reincarnated in the year 2020. And he is a 7-year-old kid in Nebraska. And Nebraska is along the coast of the U.S. And he has a memory of his previous life as Edgar Cayce. And as a 7-year-old kid, he's telling people in Nebraska this. And they all look at him and think, well, you're a funny kid. But yet he talks about, the Virginia Beach headquarters, Edgar Cayce Group and all that. And so, now this is a reading, by the way, so it's like a futuristic sort of clairvoyant looking into his own future. At one point, what they do is, according to him, they put him in a long cigar-shaped craft that is electromagnetically driven, exactly like a Vimana or these Valixes of Atlantis, and they go from Nebraska to Virginia Beach in one of these craft. Now, to me, these craft are identical to an ancient Vimana or Valix. Now, either these craft are going to be built again here in the United States by somebody using this technology, or there's even the suggestion, incredibly, that some of these craft are still around after all these thousands of years. And that can actually be something of a sort of bizarre twist on the UFO phenomenon, in that perhaps some UFOs are actually ancient craft.
David, let's talk a little bit about the Vimanas today.
Okay. Well, for instance, an interesting book that some of your listeners might be aware of, the author Lobsang Rampa, who wrote the popular book The Third Eye, his fourth book was a book called The Cave of the Ancients. And in that book, he talks about how in underground tunnels and caves in Tibet, there are still these ancient machines are being kept from the time of the Rama Empire and Atlantis, and the monks there are sort of diligently keeping them preserved or whatever, but don't know exactly what to do with them per se. And it's a fascinating idea that the manas from ancient times technology could have been secreted and kept in secret areas around the world until the time was right for them to be used again. And it's certainly quite possible that when you build something and make it to last with high-quality precision construction, and particularly if it's built out of certain metals and things like that, it's not going to corrode. Many times these Vimanas seem to have very few actual moving parts, and there's no reason why they couldn't last for thousands of years, particularly if they're well-preserved. So the idea that some people still have Vimanas and that Vimanas were coming down through ancient times, I think is very credible thought. It's said that King Solomon, in the Kebra Nagast, which is an Ethiopian text, which has to do with him and the Queen of Sheba, and Ethiopian emperors were always descended from King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, and he was said to have one of these Vimanas himself. And the time of King Solomon is about 1000 B.C., so, apparently it seems unlikely that Vimanas were still being built in ancient India at that time, but that some of the Vimanas were still around and available to certain people. You have to be a very wealthy sort of ruler, and you might, be able to get a Vimana or, something like that. It sounds incredible. The Russian explorer, Nicholas Roerich, who explored Tibet back in the 30s, he too would talk about these ancient craft, and he would give hints that in secret tunnels and caves in the Himalayas and Tibet that these ancient machines still exist. It's quite possible he even witnessed and saw some of those craft. Now, that this scenario sounds pretty far-fetched, just to draw a modern analogy, take, for instance, Cheyenne Mountain, which is just outside of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Cheyenne Mountain is the head of the NORAD Defense Command, and it is literally a hollowed-out mountain of the Rockies there in southeastern Colorado, and inside that mountain is a city with all kinds of super high-tech weaponry and radar installations and God knows what's in there. I mean, it's all totally super secret, yet absolutely exists. I mean, the government can't deny it. And if for some reason in a cataclysmic pole shift or some devastating war just wiped out civilization on this planet, it's possible that people like in Cheyenne Mountain would sort of come out after 90 days, to this smoking radioactive wasteland where, at this point, planet Earth would have been gone back to the Stone Age, largely through its own doing. And yet, these guys in Cheyenne Mountain, with all their high-tech, gizmos and equipment and whatever kind of aircraft they might have developed, and they do actually have aircraft in these underground cities and hollowed-out mountains. I mean, this is just modern-day stuff. I mean, suddenly we'll have an event, something very similar to what we're talking about, in that ancient Vimanas of that time have somehow been preserved inside mountains and secret underground caves and things like that in India and Tibet, wherever.
David, what does UFO researcher Jacques Vallée say about this?
Well, Vallée, if you read his books, and I think they're very good books about the UFO enigma, and he definitely has a different point of view than your average UFO researcher, and he sees, I think, something going on there where Vallée has often argued that the overwhelmingly popular belief that UFOs are all extraterrestrial vehicles piloted by whatever, small gray aliens or that kind of thing. I mean, Vallée has challenged that belief quite a bit, and he has shown in his books, which I think are good, is that many of the occupants of these UFOs and people have had various encounters, that the people are totally human. And oftentimes, you know, eating mundane things like pancakes and dressed in little jumpsuits. And they speak English, sometimes with a bit of an odd accent or something like that. Many times they look Oriental or Tibetan types. And their interactions with people are not sinister at all, but oftentimes all they want is a pitcher of water or something like that. And Valet is often, he's very puzzled by these kind of encounters, you know, and except for the very fact that they're in this flying saucer, otherwise their encounters with humans are very mundane and I mean, seemingly normal, you know, kind of interaction. And he finds that very, very strange and oftentimes puts some kind of interdimensional aspect to this. Another interesting solution to that is that these people are coming from the future, and it's always been, a fascinating speculation that many flying saucers are themselves also interdimensional and inter-time-traveling kind of craft as well. But so it seems that, particularly in light of Jacques Vallée's research, that some kind of Vimana craft coming back from ancient Indian Atlantis and somehow still preserved today is a solution, at least to some UFO encounters.
Well, I think this has been an incredible interview. I want to review just for a moment, for those of you who may have missed a few things, that this aircraft that we're talking about is certainly, most importantly, comes from ancient Indian text, and specifically the Vimanika Shastra text. And David, that's actually included in your book, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. The entire Vimanika Shastra text in English is included in my book. My book is in three parts. The first part is a discussion on ancient Indian technology and what ancient India was really like. Plus, I show how in ancient Egypt and other areas, pretty high technological devices were known, including electricity. Then the middle part of the book is the actual Vimanika Shastra itself in its entirety, including the title page in English and in Sanskrit. And then the third book, portion book three of the book, is then an analysis of Atlantean technology with an analysis of the Vimanika Shastra and the technology, including these Mercury gyros, and finally a chapter which is all about UFOs and Vimanas today and how certain UFO sightings seem to relate to the Vimana subject.
All right. For those of you who have been listening, this is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. My guest today, David Hatcher Childress, author of, my goodness, it looks like about seven books, maybe nine books here. Most importantly, the one we're talking about, Vimana Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis. David, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Oh, I really enjoyed it.
And I want to say this, David, you got about 30 seconds. What would you like to tell our audience?
I would say that, you know, we're coming into a whole new era now, and what's going to be happening in the future, I think it's going to parallel a lot of ancient history. History itself, including technology and civilization, is a cyclical effect, and the ancient Hindus very much talked about that. The cycles that the Earth goes through, they called yugas, analogous to what we call our ages. And it's like, as King Solomon himself had said, there's really nothing new under the sun. And what's happening now on planet Earth has, in a sense, happened in the past. And we're kind of reliving a lot of past events. And I believe that karma and reincarnation and just the synchronistic web of interaction between all people has led us to this point. And I mean, if Vimanas are real, we've probably all been in Vimanas at one time, you know, back in ancient times and past lives.
Thank you, David, for being on the show, and I want to thank all of you for tuning in, Timeless Voyager Radio. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.